Welcome to Community and Ecology, a KZYX special series of programs that takes an in-depth look at environmental and social issues confronting us. They include global warming, the crisis of the oceans, the nature of the economic debacle, as well as global and local responses to issues such as these. This series originates with the Mendocino Institute, a not-for-profit educational and research center located on the Mendocino coast. I'm Cal Winslow, director of the Mendocino Institute. These programs follow a highly successful conference, our Eco-Communitarian Conference, held in Casper in February this year. Our guest today is Raj Patel. Raj was the keynote speaker at the conference. Many of you will already know or know of Raj, but let me just briefly introduce him. Raj is an outstanding activist, perhaps the outstanding activist in the field of food politics today. He's a writer and a journalist. He's an author of The Value of Nothing, recently on the New York Times bestseller list. He's perhaps known most for Stuffed and Starved, a book called Indispensable by Michael Pollan. Raj is a fellow at Food First, a visiting scholar at the University of California, Berkeley, and an honorary research fellow at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa. He's a frequent visitor to our county. He lives with his family in San Francisco. Raj is going to speak with us this afternoon on several of the themes he introduced during our conference on topics in food and politics. Welcome, Raj.
Hi, Cal. It's good to be here.
Well, thanks, and thanks so much for coming. I'd like to start with this from Stuffed and Starved. There are more people starving, you write, in the world than ever. Today, Somalia is a ghastly case in point, yet there are apparently a billion people who are overweight. How do we frame this problem?
Well, I think the right way of framing it is not to look at who has food and who doesn't, but rather who has power in the food system and who doesn't. Because although it may look like hunger and obesity are opposites, and it's true that once upon a time they were. Once upon a time you could tell who was rich because they were overweight, and you could tell who was poor because they were rail thin. But these days, power in the food system isn't reflected in our bodies. And so certainly what you see in Somalia is an example of acute hunger. And there are today over a billion people who are sort of on the breadline, who, because of the global recession, are consuming less than 1,900 calories a day. But it's also true that around the world today, there are more than a billion people who are overweight. And in general, the people who are overweight are not the world's richest people. Excuse me. If you look in developed countries, in rich countries, in the global north, what you'll find invariably is that the people who are overweight tend to be at the lowest fifth of the income spectrum. In other words, people who are working class or unemployed tend to be much more the survivors of being overweight than the wealthy are, and so that should give us a clue that really what's at stake here isn't the availability of food, a question of the availability of food, but really a question about who has power in the food system. And it turns out that it's true that again that people in Somalia, in East Africa at the moment, are undergoing a particularly acute deprivation of food. But if you look around the world, hunger and obesity are in fact two sides of the same coin, or rather two points along a spectrum of disempowerment, where hunger is the most acute kind of disempowerment. But a little way up the spectrum of disempowerment, you find obesity, because if you are unable to control the calories that go into your body, but you're able to afford some calories, then the chances are that those calories are, particularly if you're living in the global north, calories that are empty, calories that come from the cheap food that we are given today, the dollar hamburgers, the food that we can eat off our laps, that seems much cheaper than the food that's rich in the kinds of nutrients we need to survive. So that, I think, is a better way of framing hunger and obesity than merely saying, well, you know, the poor are hungry and the rich are overweight. And thinking about power helps us understand not only how, you know, understand the sort of current situation, but also explains how it is that we live in such a world. The reason that we have hunger and obesity in the quantities that we do today is not because there is an insufficiency of food or an insufficiency of nutrients in the world today. On the contrary, there is enough food in the world today for everyone to eat well and nutritiously 1.5 times over. The reason that we have this inequality, this great imbalance in the way that food is distributed, is because the way food is distributed in the world today is not through on the basis of need, but is in fact through the market. And well, when you have food distributed through the market, you have one very simple rule, which is that if you have money, you get to eat, and if you don't have money, you starve. But we also have the complicating factor that in the market, the flow of food and the control over what food is provided is in the hands of a very small number of companies. In every major market in the world today, every major commodity that's traded globally, pretty much every commodity is in the hands, or the majority of the world's market of that commodity is in the hands of 4 or 5 corporations. So, for example, the global market in packaged tea, you know, the world's most popular soft drink, the global market of packaged tea is over 90% in the hands of one corporation, of Unilever. But if you look at, you know, global grain trade, for example, just a few corporations, you know, the ABCDs, the Archer Daniels Midland, Bunge, Cargill, and Dreyfus, control the majority of the global grain trade. And again, by looking at the power that these corporations wield and the way that they would like the food markets to function in order to maximize their profits, we get an insight into the kind of food that is available to those of us who have the money to buy food. And those foods are processed, they are high in salt and fat and sugar. And these are the kinds of foods that are more obesogenic and therefore lead to the kinds of epidemics of overweight that we see increasingly in the global north.
Raj, could I come in with just one question before we leave the global south and Africa? Because it does seem that we have here a kind of endless, rolling, persistent famine and this horrific spectacle of starving children. I understand you've been working on what you call the long green revolution. Can you explain that work you're doing before we go ahead?
Sure. I mean, the green revolution, it sounds like an environmentalist dream. You know, the green revolution, what we need is, you know, lots of windmills and tofu, and everything's going to be great. But the Green Revolution, in fact, refers to a series of interventions that began in the 1940s, funded by the Rockefeller Foundation in Mexico. And the idea there was to provide, through chemicals and through irrigation and through crop science, a scientific way of feeding people so that they would, that they wouldn't be hungry and therefore wouldn't be minded to overthrow the government. And so in the 1940s, these series of interventions of a technological package sort of designed to keep people well-fed so that they wouldn't become political their politics wouldn't tend towards redistribution. That kind of technological package began in the 1940s. And spread from Mexico through most of the global south, but not really towards Africa. And that's because the places that got this package of fertilizer and technology irrigation and crop science was the countries that received these technologies were countries that largely the United States, but a few other countries as well, were worried about becoming communist. And so the countries that received these what came to be called the Green Revolution technologies, and they were called Green Revolution because they were meant to prevent Red Revolution. These countries that received the Green Revolution were countries that were of strategic importance to the United States. You know, that the U.S. didn't want to become communist. So they were countries throughout Asia, particularly India. But you know, Indonesia, the Philippines, and what have you, also received these Green Revolution technologies, and they were also spread throughout Latin America. But in Africa, the geopolitics weren't so favorable to the spreading of the Green Revolution technologies, at least through the 50s and 60s. That said, there has been a lot of money spent since then trying to get the Green Revolution off the ground in Africa. And the Gates Foundation, the world's largest private philanthropic organization, is now pushing ahead quite aggressively in Africa, trying to spread fertilizers and pesticide sort of vendors and those kinds of technologies, and spreading what it calls nutritionally enhanced foods, genetically foods genetically engineered to contain nutrients to prevent certain kinds of disease in Africa. And what this is a sort of technological attempt to prevent, to prevent political change. At least that's the argument I'm making. And this idea of the long green revolution is precisely a history of how technology can be used to prevent certain kinds of progressive, or even not progressive, but radical and redistributive politics. Rather than, the original Green Revolution in Mexico was expressively designed with that end. And what we're seeing as the 21st century wears on is, again, a kind of gilding of capitalism with this kind of philanthropic edge to prevent a questioning of some of the incredible and very worrying kinds of interventions that are going on in Africa at the moment, things like land grabs, for instance. And various kinds of investment in Africa that are incredibly worrying if we're concerned about the ability of Africans to be able to feed themselves.
This is KZYX, and we're listening to Raj Patel. Raj is the author of Stuffed and Starved, and he's talking with us today about food politics. I have another question related but slightly different. How does the fact that we seem to be constantly at war, Raj, fit into all of this? Bush and Cheney promised us endless war, and they've certainly delivered. Now Obama seems to be following in step. Is there any connection between the politics of war, the war economies, and the politics of food?
Oh, there are incredibly deep connections between the two. I mean, the very idea of keeping food preserved and having being able to transport food over long distances internationally, that was something that emerged from the needs of the French war machine in the 19th century. The technologies of preservation and of distribution of food over transnational networks owes a great deal to war. And of course, the use of food as a weapon of war is also incredibly old. I mean, the siege, of course, is a venerable military tactic. But you don't have to go back very far to find, for example, a U.S. Secretary of State for Agriculture saying, well, and these are the words of Earl Butz, who was the Secretary of State for Agriculture under Nixon and Ford, saying, "Hungry men listen only to those who have a piece of bread. Food is a tool. It is a weapon in the U.S. negotiating kit." So absolutely, food has long been a part of the war effort. And whether it's using food as a carrot or a stick in persuading countries to go one way or another in their foreign policy, for example, in India in the 1960s, because India was critical of the U.S. intervention in Vietnam, the U.S. responded by putting India on a month-to-month food aid renewal. Now, not many Americans know or remember that, but in India, it's still a kind of stinging source of national humiliation that India had its begging bowl out every month so that the U.S. would fill it if India had behaved itself. So food is absolutely part of the broad military spectrum that the U.S. Pushes forward. And what's very interesting and very troubling is the way that the Pentagon is thinking also about food in the future increasingly worried about how climate change is going to affect U.S. interests overseas. And what's interesting is how the trade regime, the international trade regime, in which the U.S. is out to feed the world, is also, and the U.S. is sort of presenting itself as, again, you can find this in President Obama's speeches about how America can feed the world. That is being considered by the Pentagon to be a strategic advantage, so that as climate change in the future erodes all countries, it will erode the U.S. comparatively less. And so climate change puts the U.S. in a much, given that we have an international trade regime that looks the way that it does, with the U.S. dominant in it in the way that it currently is, projecting that forward into the future, when everyone gets hit by climate change, the U.S. will come out on top, in part because of the structure of international trade and because of the U.S.'s primacy and the ability to provide food. So there's no sidestepping the issue of food and war when it comes, food and its connection to the war machine. And that's something to bear in mind as we move forward, that although food can often be considered to be the sort of local and parochial issue and something that we can think about, and if only we grow our own kale, everything is going to be fine. In fact, food, U.S. food, is part of a much bigger political picture, not just in the past, but also in the future.
Okay. How about turning the discussion a bit now and telling us a bit about how you account for the interest today in what I've called food politics? And what kind of potential do you see in food politics in this country, in the North, the global North, or the on a world scale? Could you give us some idea of where you think this is coming from and what kind of potential there might be?
Well, I mean, I'm currently enamored of a group from Oakland that decided that what was needed was to make sure that every kid went to school with a good meal in his or her belly, and that that meal could be found as much as possible from resources within the local neighborhood, that group, of course, was the Black Panthers. Now, many people think that right now we have a kind of fluffy, sort of granola-ish, sort of middle-class green movement that's interested in local food. But actually, the U.S. has a fantastic history of thinking about food in radical ways that are about community control around the food system. What's interesting about the Black Panthers' survival programs, they were called, the Black Panthers recognized that if you're going to have meaningful social change, the people who are going to be part of that social change have real needs that that need to be met just to be able to survive day to day. And so the Black Panthers had over 40 different programs designed to help people survive day to day so that they could plan for the future. And these survival programs ranged from everything from these free breakfasts for black and poor children. So it was open to kids of all races within the neighborhoods that the Black Panthers found themselves in the late 60s and early 70s. But also, the Black Panthers were interested in everything from free shoes to a sort of walking home service for elderly people who felt unsafe in the neighborhood, to research on sickle cell anemia, which affected. Which overwhelmingly affected people of color and African Americans, and so there was a range of needs that had to be met in order for progressive change to happen, and not just progressive change, but in fact radical change. These survival programs were intended for survival pending revolution, and they were successful. The Black Panthers ended up feeding more people in the state of California than the government did, and. They were, in fact, it was one of the reasons why J. Edgar Hoover was threatened and felt that the Black Panthers were a profound threat, is because they were winning over support from people who were initially suspicious of the Black Panthers, because they were, in fact, successfully feeding children. And although a great deal of resources were spent by the FBI trying to find criminal activity associated with these feeding programs, they found none. I think that radical history is one to remember now, particularly as the food movement is being encouraged to step in to fill the gaps that the state is creating through its retreat, and through the food movement is being encouraged to help feed the hungry, and everyone can sort of join together in the United Kingdom. This is the idea of the big society.
Could you say a word about that retreat? What does that retreat involve?
Well, I mean, if you want to see it at its nadir, you can look to the United Kingdom, where massive cuts were implemented as a response to the recession. And you know, of course, there was a deficit, and there are always two ways to plug that deficit. One is to cut services, and the other is to increase taxes on the rich. And because of the ideological bent of the UK government, the path that was chosen was to slash benefits for the poor, and particularly for women. And so that retreat meant reductions in childcare benefits, for example. Reductions in funding for volunteer services, for social services, and an encouragement instead for everyone to get together, and understanding that we live in one big society, and this is Prime Minister Cameron's idea we must all get together and bond and realize that we're all in it together, in a kind of blitz mentality of. We'll all fight off the recession as one nation, but of course, the big difference is that in the Blitz and in the Second World War in Britain, although of course class differences were very great, the inequality was nowhere near as pronounced as it is now in the United Kingdom, and the retreat of the state means that what we see instead is. The recession and the cuts that come after it are effectively an alibi for the transfer of costs from the rich to the poor, and so although although Wall Street caused as we all know caused this particular crisis, those who have to mop up are not the ones who are living in mansions, and we've recently seen the Warren Buffett's a newspaper piece, his op-ed, encouraging the Obama administration to tax the wealthy, and that sentiment is one that's being rejected by his wealthy comrades. But the point here is that what we're seeing is an invitation by conservative forces for this kind of by a sort of coalition of social forces to take over the job that once had been ascribed to the state, and that's a danger. The idea that what we have to do is all band together and merely patch up the failures of capitalism so that capitalism can hobble on. I think something that's incredibly worrying, and that's why it's useful to look at the Black Panthers. The Black Panthers, again, when they talk about this idea of survival pending revolution, what they recognize is, yes, of course, there is among the poor a dignified emergency. There is absolutely the need to feed the hungry, to make sure that people who are unemployed have access to food. But that's not going to solve unemployment. Merely having a full belly isn't the same thing as having being part of a community where you get to direct your own work and be able to have some sovereignty over your future. And that's why the idea of survival pending revolution matters. And that's something that I'm excited by. I'm excited for us to be able to reclaim in the food movement in the U.S. and around the world. And there are groups that are taking this idea seriously. I think that's something, again, that's important to bear in mind as the food movement moves forward, because what sometimes is a distraction is this idea that, if only we grow our food locally and we go to the local farmers market, then everything's going to be fine. But the trouble is that doesn't, merely having a local farmers market, we can imagine America with a farmers market on the street every day in every town, but that doesn't mean that everyone's going to be able to afford to shop there. And it doesn't mean that a farmer's market doesn't of itself guarantee that labor is treated well. There's no guarantee that just because something says organic on it, for example, that workers are well treated. And in fact, in California, we had last year a case of a woman dying in the fields of the Central Valley for being denied access to water while she was working on an organic farm. So I think that we ought to broaden our understanding of what the food movement is away from merely consuming good food, though of course I think good food is a good thing and pleasure is vital in this as a part of this movement. But pleasure in and of itself isn't sufficient, and we do need to be thinking about the politics of labor and certainly the politics of sustainability and the politics of what comes next, of how we control and redistribute resources, as well as how we consume food.
I wonder, do you think we ought to be making demands on the state? I remember back in the last deep crisis in the recessions of the 1970s, I was living in Detroit, and there were massive distributions of free food, food that probably would turn many of our stomachs today, Velveeta cheese and so forth, but people would line up in the thousands to get distributions in those years. What do you think about that, making demands upon the state for feeding? That seems to be that's kind of going in a different direction from the Panther sort of self-help.
Well, I mean, I think that there's, I mean, at some level, of course, you know, merely demanding that the USDA provide its processed cheese or, you know, its surplus commodities to feed the hungry is, I mean, that's certainly the way that the food aid looks today. But if you look at what's happening in Detroit at the moment, Detroit is kind of a hub of experimentation of and vision about what happens when capital retreats, and within downtown Detroit, there are no supermarkets there, and communities have organized. You know, different community groups have organized it to, be able to re-envision how food ought to circulate within Detroit. And the state matters. It matters in order to, you know, I mean, to be able to guarantee, for example, access to land for people to farm. And I mean, I think that there's still a firm conviction within activist groups in downtown Detroit that that government ought to be responsive to the needs of the people. Now, that's very different from merely abdicating, responsibility or power to government and asking the government merely to hand over the stuff, whatever that stuff is, because, you know, again, if you look at the way food aid works within the United States, the food aid program and the food stamp program, or the SNAP entitlement program, as it's now called, is largely a way of just sort of recycling food, recycling dollars back into the hands of big food or big agriculture. But that's not to say that particularly local government doesn't have a role to play in supporting some of these movements. And in fact, there are across the country and across North America now nearly 200 food policy councils, which are municipal organizations that involve local government, but also community activists, farm workers, farmers, local retailers, people working in schools and institutional providers of food, getting together to make sure that everyone in the community gets to eat. And by doing things like that, you start figuring out ways in which people can control government again, and you can have a kind of genuine, effective democracy as opposed to the kind of democracy and the kind of food coming out of that democracy that involves large blocks of USDA cheese. That kind of democracy of engaging and controlling local and municipal institutions is, I think, the kind of demand of the state that I'm much more excited by, rather than just sort of asking the USDA to fix a hunger problem, because that's not really what the USDA is for. The USDA is really the Department of Big Food, and that's, I don't see a way in which asking the Department of Agriculture to fix hunger is going to, is a progressive step forward. I think, like many sort of commentators on this issue, that the USDA really does need to be disbanded. We need a different kind of institution in its stead. But that doesn't—that's not to say that there isn't a role for there isn't a role for government in making sure that everyone gets to eat. But I think that what precisely that role is something that has to come out of a democratic politics, as opposed to the kind of lobbying fest that generated the USDA in the first place.
This is KZYX. My name is Cal Winslow. I'm the director of the Mendocino Institute, and this program today is part of a special series KZYX is sponsoring on environmental and social issues in Mendocino County. Our guest speaker today is Raj Patel, the well-known activist and writer and intellectual who has written extensively on food politics. His best-known book is called Stuffed and Starved. And we're going to continue with a few more questions on this subject. I wonder if we could, you know a bit about our county. I know you've been up here and you have many friends up here. I wonder if we could turn for a few minutes to more local issues. You know that there's a great deal of enthusiastic interest in food politics, local politics here in Mendocino County. At the same time, there's plenty of hunger here. And we also have what are called food deserts, even though this is a rural California county. But like so much of the country in Mendocino, barely more than 1% of food consumed here is produced locally. How can we begin to come to terms with a contradiction like this? I think both practically, but also politically.
Well, I mean, I think you nailed it there. The problem. I mean, and you're right, Cal, that actually this is a national problem. That although people tend to think of food deserts as happening within urban areas and inner cities where it is hard to find fresh fruits and vegetables, it's also the case that there are food deserts throughout the United States in rural areas where it is hard for local communities to have access to fresh fruits and vegetables. And of course, in part, that's just because a lot of the food grown in the United States isn't fresh fruits or vegetables. It's commodity crops and cereals. People don't eat cow corn and people don't eat raw soy. It requires processing. And of course, that's right there, you get an insight just by looking at what it is that's in the field of how the food, the food industry works. A great deal of our land is turned over to the growing of things that are not directly for human consumption, but either for animals or, increasingly in the United States, for biofuels. We're growing food not in order to eat, but to set on fire. And I think it's important then to look around Mendocino and to see what it is that is in fact being grown. The links between the uses of land in Mendocino and the availability of good fresh fruits and vegetables for people on low incomes, and I think that's the other, that's always the missing ingredient, if you like, the missing element in discussions around food and food politics, where there is a lot of enthusiasm, and I don't want to put the smack down on people who are enthusiastic about shopping at local farmers markets, because I do that and I think it's terrific, but if we don't pay attention to how it is poverty and food insecurity is able to exist side by side with fields full of things, then we're missing a beat. And I think particularly when one looks at the data in the United States and sees that there are 50 million people in the United States who are food insecure, which is to say that people who don't know at some point during the year don't know where their next meal is coming from. 50 million people in the United States are in that sort of position of precariousness, we do need to be asking the tough question about why that is and what it is that we can do about it. And solving that kind of problem isn't something that you can shop for at a farmer's market. It does mean taking seriously the issue, the questions around, well, who is it that is who is unable to buy food in our community? And invariably, when one looks at the data around hunger, one finds that, for example, households headed by women in the United States are very likely to be, much more likely to be going without food at some point during the year than other households, for instance. And that's because, you know, the society in which we live is one that that penalizes women, where we don't provide things like you know, support for things like childcare, where you know, more women are on you know, are at minimum wage than men, and that, you know, that kind of issue, I think, is something that feels very far away from food politics. But at this point, I think it's important to bear in mind that, in fact, around the world, there are people facing these issues too. There's an international peasant movement called La Via Campesina, the peasant way. And they have this idea called food sovereignty. Now, food sovereignty is, I mean, it has a long definition, and I would encourage people to look up that definition. There's a great Wikipedia article on it. You can go to foodsovereignty.org or viacampesina.org to find out. But basically, food sovereignty is about this idea that communities need to be able to control their own food system, to be able to banish hunger within their community. But there's a shorthand for that. And the way Via Campesina talk about food sovereignty, and you know, this group of 150 million peasants and rural workers and farmers, including within the United States, the National Family Farm Coalition and the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in Florida and the Border Workers Union, these groups have a shorthand for thinking about power in the food system. And what they have, you know, their shorthand is that food sovereignty is about an end to all forms of violence against women. Food sovereignty is about an end to all forms of violence against women. Now, that's a strange thing for a peasant movement to be saying, and you know, particularly if one's concern is initially about, you know, farmers' markets and community-supported agriculture. Violence against women seems to be a very long way away. But think about it for a second, and all of a sudden it starts becoming clearer that actually if we want democracy in our food system, if we want democracy anywhere, then we do need to be thinking about systematically about about us being equal in having that democracy, and if we want equality in that democracy, then we ought to look at who's going hungry in the world today. And 60% of the people going hungry in the world today are women or girls, and that's not an accident. That's part of the way that our global food system works, and it works that way in the United States too. So thinking about inequality and thinking about power locally, and that means in Mendocino, means also thinking about gender, but it also means thinking about labor, about who it is that's doing the work in the field. It means thinking about who has the income to be able to afford fresh fruits and vegetables in the farmers market. It means thinking about meals on wheels services. I mean, that's one of the ideas that blossomed here in the Bay Area was a meals on wheels service that was sustainable and involved locally produced food for seniors who were unable to get to the farmers market and were able to afford a CSA. And thinking then about poverty and about access to food makes the food movement not only a much richer place to be, but it brings it closer to ideas of justice and democracy that I think it desperately needs right now.
One last, or possibly two last questions. You're very well aware of the fact that the demographics of the state of California are changing dramatically and radically, and they are certainly here in Mendocino County. And that the fastest growing groups, the people whose origins are in Mexico and Central America, these fast growing groups, which are the youngest, probably the most energetic, are going to be, it seems, the majority of the working class in counties like Mendocino before too long. I wonder what you've thought about how to make some connection between what seems to be a mostly Anglo movement, food politics, and this growing part of our population, many of whom, these people whose origins are in Central America and Mexico, many who have agricultural backgrounds themselves and are the majority of the agricultural workers in a county like this now.
Well, I mean, Cal, I thought that the conference that the Mendocino Institute held was a great example of how to do that by, firstly, by respectfully inviting members and representatives and leaders from the Latino community into a discussion about the kind of Mendocino that was that everyone would like to see, but also by acknowledging that in fact people from Central America and Mexico are also coming to Northern California with experiences and histories of organizing and of memories and traditions and lived experience of organizing around food and food justice. It seems to me that working with groups that already exist by providing space and resources for groups to come together and to reconstitute themselves in new ways in Northern California is tremendously important. The kind of experience of migrant organizing that brought about the coalition of Immokalee workers in southern Florida, for example, where there was strong support from church groups, but also from student groups and from consumer organizations, providing that kind of environment that was ready to support and to listen and to nurture the groups that were formed around workers organizing in fields for their rights, provided an incredibly rich addition to the U.S. food movement and helped provide leadership to the U.S. food movement. And I think that kind of environment, an environment that doesn't seek to impose organizing on Latino workers who have who already know how to organize and are already in the process of fighting for their rights and constituting themselves into different organizations, providing resources and availability and platforms and solidarity with their demands is the best way of building that kind of united food movement that again is I think the hope for everyone in the United States ultimately to be able to eat.
And one last question before we wrap up. I've been working with a new union, a union of healthcare workers in California, the National Union of Healthcare Workers. And in following their struggles and their attempts to rebuild in hospitals and healthcare settings across the state, I've noticed at the same time that there seems to be possibly some new stirrings in the labor movement. Of course, we all know about Madison and the big demonstrations in Madison, which seem to probably, unfortunately, been channeled into electoral activity. But we have that big explosion. And now we have the biggest strike in the recent past taking place, the strike of the Verizon workers, the telephone workers. I wonder what possibilities there might be for making a connection between the concerns that people have about food and the organized or the yet-to-be-organized labor movement. Have you thought about that at all?
I have, and I think that there's, I mean, when one looks at who it is that's systematically the least paid in the United States, absolutely, one comes across the food system. And of course, there are, if you look at the groups that are prohibited from unionizing, again, you come across agricultural workers, and domestic workers, of course, are also another group that are, that find considerable barriers in their unionizing. And again, this comes back to this idea of work and discrimination against women. But I think that there are important connections that are in the process of being made and that deserve to be much stronger. I mean, whether it's hotel and restaurant workers, obviously meat packers had their unions broken a while ago. But I think that there's that there's plenty of space and there's plenty of opportunity within the food movement, particularly given that. All along the food chain, workers are, whether you're in the fields or whether you're at Walmart, systematically underpaid and exploited. There's plenty of room to think about union organizing. And one of the areas that I'm really excited by and excited to sort of push forward with is also thinking about, after the food is produced and then after it's consumed, the consequences of eating the way that we do also matters. And that's why the U.S. has phenomenally high rates of, for example, type 2 diabetes. And Some of the groups I've been having conversations with are involved in the healthcare industry, and I've been talking to a few nurses, for example, and nurses union organizers, because they're very concerned, and you know they're frankly annoyed and angry that they find themselves treating the same patients over and over again for the same kinds of disease and the same kinds of you know diet-related illnesses, and then the patients have very little choice but to go, they have very little choice about where they eat other than the place with the cheapest food. And the place with the cheapest food in many of these neighborhoods is, you know, are fast food restaurants rather than places where they can access fresh fruits and vegetables. So from the medical point of view, there's also some stirrings and organizing happening there. And I would be delighted if that were to spread, particularly in California, where we have a nurses union that's actually pretty strong and pretty progressive.
Well, I think this has been terrific, Raj, and I hope our listeners think so as well. And I'd like to thank you not just for talking to us today, but for the support that you've given to many people up here in Mendocino County over the years. I know you know it's appreciated, but it certainly is. It's been a great pleasure to speak to you. Good luck on your latest projects. We look forward to your next book. And that we hope that it won't be too long before you come back here to visit us in Mendocino County. So thanks, Raj. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Cal. And thank you for the work that you're doing there. And again, for providing the kind of opportunity for a platform for organizing that I think is going to be vital in moving towards a sustainable Mendocino. So thank you.
Great. Thanks, Raj.
All right. Take care, Cal.
I hope that listeners will return next week when this series continues. It's going to last for about 6 weeks this fall. And among speakers who you can look forward to hearing will be Will Russell, who's an authority on forest restoration and environmentalist at San Jose State University, Sasha Lilly, who's the author of Capitalism and Its Discontents, is scheduled to come on. We have much more to come. Thank you again for listening. This is Cal Winslow. I'm the director of the Mendocino Institute, and we will be back on air in a week. Thanks. Bye.